Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own, and we don't take instructions from anyone else. We are thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 370 of Registry Matters. Larry? Probably need to find some crickets to chime in for Larry at this point. So before we get any further with how this is going to work this evening, please show your support by hitting like and subscribe, 5-star review, rating in your podcast app. You know all those things. It helps us out a lot. Helps anybody new find us. And then if you're feeling extra generous, you could head over to patreon.com/registrymatters and show support for the program. And that would be fantabulous. So, but this week, I have a guest joining us tonight, and we're going to cover a story. We're going to cover a case, I guess, that, so there are registry systems in the United States, and particularly one that we're going to talk about tonight, that they have fees associated with them. So we're going to dig into that tonight with our guest, who is the paralegal for NARSOL. He's been doing this work for more than 10 years, possibly even as much as 15. He does all the case announcements for NARSOL. And he is the chair of the NARSOL Legal Committee. And his name is, here's his first, middle, and last name. And that is Stephen the Paralegal. There you go. Stephen, how are you tonight? Welcome.
Andy, thanks. That's a perfect intro.
Perfect. Perfect. We can go home now.
Okay.
So I guess we can, could you give me a brief intro, you know, a 60-second of where we are, how we got here, and then I have a handful of questions to cover for this.
Well, certainly. You mean in reference to the case?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So basically, various states across the country have registry fees that are attached to the registration process, and West Virginia implemented one that started in January 1st of 2026, and NARSOL in October of 2025 filed a lawsuit about that registration fee, which we contest is, instead of a fee, it is a fine.
Would you do me the legal breakdown of what the difference between a fee and a fine would be?
So yeah, there is a fine line, and there's been a number of cases across the country, 9, in fact. Some of them are state cases, some of them are federal. And the courts have pretty much determined what a fee is and a fine is. And a fee would be a financial obligation by the registrant, in this case, that is paying for an actual service. Now, they don't have to benefit from the service. Matter of fact, you probably understand most registrants don't benefit from the registry.
No, we don't.
In general, it doesn't happen. But the fee needs to go towards maintenance, administration, compliance, verification of the various registration functions in each and every state. So the courts have said, if you're paying a fee that's excessive, in other words, it goes beyond what it actually costs the state to implement the registration function, that would be a fine. That comes under the Eighth Amendment, under excessive fees or fines in this case. If it goes to something entirely unrelated to the registration function, the federal courts at least have said that that would be a tax and not a fee. So that's the fine line.
Excellent. All right. Then tell me about who, I'm not interested in who the plaintiffs are. Tell me about the plaintiffs and what is their day-to-day experience with this fee look like?
So the process, of course, it just started in January of this year, and between January and June, registrants in the state, there's about 6,700 now registrants in West Virginia, have to pay a fee of $125. They pay it to the circuit clerk in their county, and then the clerk sends that over to the West Virginia State Police. And that is the requirement. Within 10 days, they have to go into the Western State Police, tell them they paid their fee, and then they're good to go. Now, the problem is, Andy, if they don't pay that fee, what happens? Well, in West Virginia, in the statutes, they actually place a lien on any property you have in your county if you don't pay for it. So if you own property in your county and it's and you don't pay this fee, then you have a lien placed on your property. So if you're ever going to sell your property or what have you, they're going to extract that out before you sell your property.
That's funky. And I'm, you know, like, I'm just going to kind of play devil's advocate. I mean, that's like $10 a month. Is that such a big deal? Really? Just 10 bucks a month?
Well, here's the issue, Andy. So let's say it's $125. Of course, that's one of the higher fees in the country. But if we have $125, that's about $2.50 per week and for the rest of your life. Because in the state of West Virginia, very difficult. Well, there is no means of getting off the registry in West Virginia. There's no hearing. There's no analysis of risk assessment, et cetera, that a lot of other states have. It's a non-compliant federal form of state. So basically, the fee is implemented for a lifetime. And that is a problem.
So you're a young man, though. You know, you're in your 20s, and so you're going to pay for the rest of your life. We'll assume that you're going to live for another 60 years, 125, 60 years. That's a good chunk of change out of your pocket.
I mean, over time, it accumulates. Now, one other issue that started this year as well in West Virginia is there's another registry in West Virginia called the Central Abuse Registry. And as of last year, if you're on the sex offender registry in West Virginia, you're also on the Central Abuse Registry that you just get sent over there. And by the way, there's another $125 fee for that, which would be $250 a year, $5 a week for life. How'd you like that one?
That sounds way better. $250 is way better than $125. So for those of people that are unfamiliar with how is the West Virginia registry different than others in the United States? Is it any like significantly different than the others? Since have, you know, 57 states, general, I think, at this point?
Yeah. I mean, in general, it's very similar to other states. It's, as I said, it's not compliant with federal SORNA. Many states aren't. There's no tiering in West Virginia, so everybody's in the same boat, so to speak. And there's no means of petitioning to get off the registry. There's no means of analysis of risk assessment or riskiness to society in general. So in general, you're basically registering annually in your birth month. And if you're an SVP, which I think there's about 65, they register quarterly. And of course, if you have to make updates, you have to do that within 10 days in person. So I would say in most respects, it's similar to other states. We have no premises restrictions in the state if you're not on probation or parole. And so some things are better than other states, some things are worse, but
sure.
In general, that's the status.
How did this particular challenge come together? So what was the path from identifying the problem to filing it in federal court?
Well, the problem, initially, when I analyze these cases or any case that I think can be contested in various states, initially I looked at across the country, okay, which states have a registry fee? So right now there's 25 states, and that includes the District of Columbia, that have a registry fee, and the other half do not. So we were somewhat surprised whenever they brought it to West Virginia. There's only one other state in the Fourth Federal Circuit is South Carolina. They have a registry fee of $150. Then South Carolina and Tennessee are tied for the highest fee in the country.
Wow.
But again, you know, 24, 25 states do not have a registry fee yet. So you want to be aware of this because states like to collect fees if they can. And we talked before the show, Andy, if they collect $125, So the residents in West Virginia, they're going to be bringing in 800,000 plus a year.
And just by comparison, Georgia has, it's probably 30,000 now since I last paid attention to it. And that's a radically different number at $125 a person, where you're talking 6,700 equals 800,000, times that by four. And you're talking like, I mean, 800 is some real money, but times that by four or five, or like, that's some big money.
It's a chunk of change. I mean, the interesting thing is some of these courts that have looked at these other cases, nine other cases in the other courts, they look and see what has made it constitutional in most states to date that you can have a registry fee is that the registry fee has to go specifically towards the maintenance of the registry. And what's most important is you can assess through the discovery process in a lawsuit, you can find out how much it actually costs to maintain your registry. And if the fee is exceeding that, that can be considered a fine. So that's probably one thing that'll happen in the West Virginia case.
A question in chat just was asked, could this be called a disability and restraint to show that the registry is punitive and not just civil?
So there's one case that there was an ex post facto challenge. That is that the fee was actually punitive. It's in the state of New York. I'll look up the case here real quick. It's Cohen. It was in 2006. People v. Cohen, 2006. They found that the registry fee was punitive, and therefore it could not be applied to people that had got on the registry prior to its implementation. So that's kind of an outlier that it's actually a punitive measure, particularly when it's considered a fee. Not many other cases have followed that, but it's a possibility. We didn't contest that in regards to being an ex post facto punitive measure in this case, but it has been found at least in one other court.
So that $800,000, where does that money go? Who receives that? What do they do with it?
So that is the real question. So one of the things I did when I analyzed this case, and anybody listening to this can go and find it out in your own state, I looked at what's called a federal book in your state. So you can look up, for example, federal book for the fiscal year 2025 in Georgia. And you can find a PDF, and it'll tell you where your state's getting money at from currently. So West Virginia, when you look it up, will they be bringing in $800,000 plus from this one? But they also currently get, for example, under the Adam Walsh Act, the state of West Virginia, for overtime supplies, equipment to enhance the sex offender registration and notification of the Adam Walsh Act, gets $100,075 per year. So we already get $100,000 from the federal government to maintain the registry. In addition, they also get $400,000 that goes to compliance checks for registrants. And that's through the U.S. Marshals Service.
Sure.
So we already know they get over $500,000 a year from other sources to maintain the registry. The question is, Andy, how much does it cost to update a registrant when they come in once a year? I don't think it's $800,000 a year. I don't know. What do you think?
Let's just say it takes 1 hour of a officer's time to handle all of the things that are involved with you updating your address and car and photo and fingerprints. And let's just say it's an hour. I don't think the police officer is making $125 an hour to like justify it down that way.
it's kind of crazy actually, but
it's gotta be all the extra computer time, you know, Palantir or whatever AI system they're using to pay for all that server time.
I presume they would come up with something, but I find it, you know, when they implemented this law, they went through the legislation, and we have copies of what the legislators were told by the state police and such. And, of course, they never mentioned they already got $500,000 a year from the federal government for this. They forgot to mention that. But it's interesting some of the comments that actually came about on why they wanted to see. And You know, it'll be interesting to see during Discovery what they actually say their costs are. There's been other states that, for example, New Hampshire disclosed that it costs them $17 a year to maintain a registry.
$17 a person?
$17 a year. I mean, let's think about this. Well, obviously there's a computer system that maintains this, right? So they talk to each other through the state. There was another case in Wisconsin that I think a registrant was probably one of the pro se case, but he failed to do any discovery in that he never tried to discover how much it actually costs to maintain the registry. If you're aware, or maybe you're not aware, some registrants have to pay this fee while they're in prison.
What state does that?
Wisconsin is the one I'm thinking of right now.
Well, Wisconsin also charges you even if you've left the state. The 125 or whatever it is.
That's correct.
Something I'm reading here. Something about the funding doesn't go back to supporting the registry. It's directed first towards state police mental health services and then general operations. What? I'm sorry. Do the police get some PTSD on going in and beating on your door and making sure that you live where you say you're going to live?
Let's think about this. And this is really where the contention came up, Andy, and I saw right away this is likely going to be a good case. When they craft these registration fee laws in every state to date, they've specified that fee is going towards registration, maintenance, upkeep, compliance checks, verifications, etc. West Virginia left that completely out of the statute. And as you just said, these fees go towards mental health capabilities and healthcare for West Virginia State Police, even former employees of the West Virginia State Police. And I don't know about you, you know, generally police officers aren't getting PTSD from updating registries. I don't know.
It doesn't seem like it's a really high stress job.
I mean, the fees could probably go the other way around, but I don't know.
Yes. So, in essence,
we actually have a legislator that talked to the superintendent of the West Virginia State Police, and he said he needed to hire a doctor for mental health. And that's where these fees are going. And we contend that it has nothing to do with registration, maintenance, and upkeep when you're paying for mental health of former West Virginia State Police officers. Now, it also goes to general funding, and I'm sure the state's going to claim that some of that general funding goes towards this registration fee or registration maintenance. But they kind of left it completely out of the statute, and every other statute that has been held legal to date cites that specifically in their statute, the fee goes directly towards registration functions. Sure. In general, it can't go towards other functions of the state. It can only go if it's a fee for the service is towards registration functions. So that is one of the reasons why NARSOL and our legal committee decided to go after this case.
Interesting. So back to that, West Virginia's in the Fourth Circuit, but it offers no risk-based tiering, so no individualized assessment, and there's no path for deregistration. Does that help the context of strengthening or shape the constitutional claims on the case?
It does to some extent. So I'm going to give you another example. The only other state in the Fourth Circuit that has a registry fee would be South Carolina. And it was a case that I know you and Larry talked about a while back, Powell v. Keel, that allowed a pathway for South Carolina registrants to get off the registry. And so the fee there that the registrants pay also goes towards helping people when they apply to get off the registry. Well, because West Virginia has no means or anybody to even talk to get off the registry, there's no way to do it. Almost everybody's a lifetime registrant. There should be no fee collected to get off the registry to pay for example, a motion or to get in front of a court or an analysis by some kind of sex offender treatment program. None of that's available in West Virginia. So it is another, I'll say, feather in the cap for claiming that this see is a fine, and it's not going towards any benefit for the registrant. In fact, one of the states, Massachusetts, actually said in their decision to implement the registry that they say specifically the critical question on a registry fee is whether the fees are reasonably designed to compensate an entity for the anticipated regulatory expenses. That Doe v. the Sex Offender Registry Board, 2011, Massachusetts. But they said that one of the benefits that registrants got from their fee was the regulatory scheme governing the registration of sex offenders is not wholly devoid of any benefits to the sex offender because it provides the offender with the opportunity to alter his classification level or terminate his registration obligation. Right. That is something that West Virginians aren't afforded. So,
are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Now, one of the plaintiffs is a permanently disabled individual and they're living on SSI, Medicaid, and SNAP. The statute has no indigency exception. And if you can't pay, you get a property lien. Now, how, like, that person, if they're on a very, very fixed income, does that help or does that change the case in any way? Does that create a due process and equal protection argument?
It is definitely under the 14th Amendment, there's an equal protection clause. Basically, you know, our attorney that filed this case for Narsov, he is very strong into, you know, protecting classes, particularly indigent. And in this case, and in every other state, by the way, that has a registry law, they have a disclosure in their registration law that says that they will make provisions for people with low income or indigency. And of course, West Virginia decided to leave that out of the registration law. Yeah, one of our plaintiffs, as you said, is partially paralyzed. He definitely cannot work. If you saw his annual income and you're going to take another 125 from him, I mean, I find it disturbing, actually, that he would have to pay a fee to be on that registration. The guy can barely move, and he's certainly not a harm. He can barely move. It's hard to claim that you're dangerous to somebody. But on top of that is the fee, which is quite painful.
No doubt. Now, the case was filed under 42 U.S. Code, subsection 1983, against the state police superintendent in his official capacity. Why was that approach used rather than, say, challenging the statute directly through the state court?
Well, it is possible we could do this through the state court. We like to use federal court, Sandy. I'm sure you and Larry have discussed. We have people that are, you know, not elected officials, so we generally get better decisions in federal court. And in general, because we have some other solid rulings from other federal courts, that is the reason we chose to use a civil rights action in this case. We have a very strong case on the Equal Protection Clause for the indigency. I mean, that's going to have to be forced in there somehow. I'm sure the court, I think we have a super high possibility of getting a positive ruling on that. The other part, you know, it's going to be contentious based on whether it's a tax or a fee or a fine. But I still think it's a very strong case. So
excellent. Now, of course, I always ask Larry these cases. Now, will the state, will they counter, like, what will their counter arguments be? Will they push back? And so they'll certainly argue that the fee is a reasonable regulatory cost, not a fine. And what's the strongest version of that counter argument, and how do you guys plan to overcome it?
Well, in relation to, first of all, they're going to argue that, yes, we need this money, and we're going to come back and say, okay, in discovery, how much does it actually cost for you to implement this registry function? We're going to extract that information out of them via the discovery process. I think the state, you know, of course, they file their motion to dismiss, which is general, and that's what we're waiting on right now for the state the federal court to decide. But I think they're going to have some trouble with the mental health issue. That's going to be the big contender in this case, and they're going to have to somehow weasel a way out of that on how registrants should pay for mental health. They've already alleged in some of their filings, Andy, that it's a very stressful job. And and what they've actually done is...
I'm trying to figure out how it's a stressful job for real. I mean, maybe when they all get together in their tactical gear and they're doing the Halloween sweep, like, perhaps... I don't see any part of this being all that stressful.
Well, here's what the state does. And this is how they started to argue this. Their contention is that registration, when registrants come in, that they're somehow analyzing the underlying cause of their registration. Like they're going back and analyzing DNA samples from the crime scene, and they're looking at, extremely bad, grotesque images of child pornography, and
that's not their job.
They're interviewing people, assault victims, and all those things. It has nothing to do with updating a registry, but that's how they're alleging that registrants are responsible for their high stress.
Their purpose is execute the law. Like, just your job is to just monitor this person and make sure that they are remaining compliant. You don't need to go look at what they did to arrive here, whether it was public urination or whatever the most heinous thing is. Like, their job is to just simply monitor.
Exactly. When you have a state attorney general, coming back, and this is how they argue it. You know, when it gets in front of the court, I mean, I think we'll have a good argument here with a mental health issue. And that, updating somebody's address and their email and their phone number is not that stressful. In fact, we pointed out to the court already that in some states, law enforcement does not even do registration functions. For example, Mississippi, you update your registry at the DMV. So it's going to be contentious.
Yeah, which I've heard argued is the proper place to do this, because that is where you would do it anyway, and you're already required by law under a civil regulatory scheme. I get, but if you move, you have probably like 30 days, maybe 60 days from when you move to this apartment or into that house, whatever. Like, you're not moving to a new state, but even if you did, but you're still supposed to go update your information, like, by law.
Exactly. Yeah.
So courts have historically been deferential to legislatures on registry schemes, often accepting them as civil regulatory, even when they impose significant burdens. Now, what makes you confident that this court will look at this fee differently?
Well, I think we've already hit the main part. It's the way the statute's written. First of all, there's no indigency clause. And second of all, what the fee goes towards. If it doesn't go towards registration functions, in our minds, it's unconstitutional, and it's a fine. It's not a fee, and that's really what differentiates this case. One of the other things I'd like to point out with this also, Andy, is, okay, when we talk about civil regulatory mechanisms, right, everybody understands, for example, if you went to get a driver's license, that is a civil regulatory mechanism. You pay a fee, and you get a benefit of a driver's license. Same thing with attorney's licenses and doctor's licenses and plumber's licenses. Those are all civil regulatory mechanisms that they can oversee various things in these various professions. Now, in general, when you register, you don't, in most states, we don't get a benefit for registering, right? Unless you have the ability, like some courses said, to change your tier or change your, for example, duration of registration. You can deregister. West Virginia doesn't allow that. So that's one other reason that we think West Virginia would be a good case to win.
Interesting. Now, if the court rules the fee is unconstitutional, and as I'm reading this, I'm thinking about tariffs. Now, what happens practically? Are the prior liens voided? Are past payments refundable? Or is the relief purely prospective?
This is very much like the federal tax thing. So some people have already paid their fee. Some people have paid $125. Some people have already paid $250 because their parole or probation officer said, you need to go pay this fee. So they run down to the courthouse and pay their fee. Most people are probably waiting until June 30th. Also, Andy, I didn't mention we filed for a preliminary injunction in this case. That would be where the court steps in and says, hey, there's a very good likelihood they're going to win this case, and they're going to put a preliminary injunction on the statute so they can't collect any more fees. As of today, it's still in place, but that's pending. So how would they get the fees back? I think it would be... I really don't have an answer for that, Andy. Trying to go back into a county clerk and say, hey, I want my $125 fee back. I don't know. I don't know how they're going to deal with that one.
Make sure you keep, can you pay by check and make sure you keep copies of the check? Make sure you take photos and extra photos of receipts that they have given you for paying it?
I suppose. I'm sure people would want to get a receipt. I mean, absolutely. Well, you have to take the receipt down to the West Virginia State Police Office, so you better get a receipt.
I guess like the natural last question would be on either side, if you get a negative ruling, would you appeal? And if there's a positive ruling in your favor, do you think that the state would appeal?
Well, I would generally not rule out appeal. Have to wait and see what the decision is and what the reasoning is for it. I would hope that this would be a summary judgment and not go to a trial and such. But in general, the other side's going to appeal. I mean, that's just the nature of the beast right now. They have attorneys that are staff attorneys, and they need to do something, so they'll probably appeal. If we would lose the case, we may appeal as well. That would be something, though, with our Narthol cases, we bring that back in front of the legal committee, let all of our attorneys and legal people look at it and say, is this something we should appeal or not? So that's how we deal with that.
And you just brought up a piece that I know if Larry were here, so I'm going to try and channel my inner Larry. You said something about summary judgment. And if that's the case, then the facts of the case don't get brought forward. As I understand it, I am not a legal mind. But without that, wouldn't that make it harder to challenge this in other states? Worded differently is you would want it to go to trial or go to court, whichever. And that way all the facts are brought forward. That way it would then be easier to apply it to the other 20 whatever states that have these fees.
It's true. If there are facts that are contested, then we need to go through a lengthy process of discovery and then probably a trial or certainly some hearings. So if there is contentious issues and they need to be worked out through a lengthy discovery process, then we would do that. We would go to trial, thus, you know, providing for an appellate court something to look at. Yeah. That'll be something we decide through the way. I think it's a good point. I mean, if you're aware, you know, Doe v. Smith never had an underlying trial,
yep,
and that went straight to the Supreme Court, and we got spanked. So,
yep.
If we need to have a trial, we will.
Very good. Is there anything else that you want to offer about this that we might not have covered?
No, I think we got the main things here. It's different than the other cases that have been filed. We're taking some very strong points from the other cases that we can use in this case. And in general, for states or people that are out there that might be having a fee come up, it all comes down to the wording of the statute. Sometimes legislatures get it wrong.
What do you mean sometimes? Come on.
Well, I know.
And then this also would bring home the point that laws are considered to be constitutional until they're challenged in court.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, even well, though you know they're not constitutional. Like, I've had so many complaints recently about, you know, the death sentence for certain sexual offenses. We know it's unconstitutional, but they can still make the law until somebody tells them it's not legal.
Until they're told to stop. Absolutely. Well, very good. Thank you for bringing this up. I do have something else I want to ask you about, because it's like, I mean, it is the 14th and this was filed yesterday. So talk about hot off the presses. What is this Doe's et al. Versus Mitchell?
Okay, so Doe's et al. Versus Mitchell is another case in West Virginia that was just filed yesterday. And basically this case is, if you're familiar with the Cornelio case, this is basically an internet ID disclosure case. We're contesting a statute in the state of West Virginia as well that says that one of the things you have to do, Andy, when you go in to register in that state is you have to, the statute says, provide them with any internet account you have. Any internet account. That would be Cash App, PayPal, Amazon. Social media, email addresses.
What about work ones? What about work ones? I mean, I have tons of passwords. I have a crap ton of passwords for Narsol, just to, you know, put the point very close to home. But I also have for other clients that I work with, my day job, I have over 1,000 passwords in my password manager. I have to give them all of them?
Well, they don't want passwords. They want your internet account.
Okay, so, well, still, it's still 1,000 accounts.
It's still 1,000 accounts. The question is, in this one, and there's been 14 cases here that I analyzed in this case as well. There's been 14 cases. There's been a number of states that no longer have to provide internet identifiers, like Georgia. Like, for example, California. And there's, I think, 5 other states, Kentucky, and all of these have been contested in court. Connecticut, you no longer have to provide internet identifiers. Michigan, you no longer have to provide internet identifiers. They've been contested on First Amendment grounds that you should be able to anonymously present yourself for a variety of different reasons. And also, we would contest, or we do contest in this case, that it's a vague statute. I mean, I'm not sure why they would need to know what your PayPal account is, or your bank account, or your name.
Well, you know, that banking app probably has a very social media angle that you can go chat with all the people with through your banking app.
We actually have some information from some of the registrants in the state on the various things that they're asked about in regards to their cell phones, what's on their cell phone, you know, what apps they have. And it seems rather bizarre that they would need to know what your Cash App handle is. I don't know. I don't know too many people that are trying to solicit someone with their Cash App.
I don't know. You can leave some pretty spicy comments in Cash App about what you gave money for. People will say, hey, I paid for my rent, or I paid for a hot night.
Well, I guess if you stretch it. But we're going to contest that they've never used this information ever in the state of West Virginia, just like they did in Cornelio. If you remember the Cornelio case.
I do not, though.
You don't remember? You're kidding.
Really don't.
That was a case that Paul Dubling did from North Carolina. Cornelio was actually an attorney from New York State, but he was in Connecticut, and he contested that he didn't need to provide internet identifiers. During the discovery process in that case, the state disclosed that in the 15 years that they've had the internet identifier requirement to be disclosed, they've never used it once. To solve a crime, to prevent a crime, anything. And we kind of figure that's the case in most states, that they don't use this information at all. And then, for example, in West Virginia, they put the internet identifiers online so people can search for them.
Yeah.
So we contest that this is unconstitutional. And that case was just filed. And we filed for anonymity in the case as well, which means that our plaintiffs in this case remain anonymous. So I think it's a pretty strong case, though. This is actually a very strong case because we have some really other good federal court decisions in this avenue or area of law that we think we have a pretty good winnable case here.
And on that, though, how active is the West Virginia affiliate at going to the state and trying to pressure to keep these things from being signed?
Well, this year they were extremely good. I mean, they had at least a half a dozen registry laws that none of them made out of committee. So West Virginia RSOL was pretty strong in that category. I mean, try to do the best they can, you know, with limited help. You know, there's hundreds of people on the helping out. But in general, they've been able to prevent most of these laws from coming into effect. This internet identifier law has been on the books for, you know, decades. So
Oh, okay.
They're just coming around now to trying to get rid of this thing. And I think they have a pretty good shot there in that case as well. Narthol, our legal committee, basically, we look at these cases. If we don't have a very good likelihood of success, we're not going to bring the case. So
sure.
This is our fourth case in the last year, and we think it's a pretty good one.
Fantastic. And, well, since you did that, are there any other interesting cases that NARSL has that might be brought that you could talk about?
Well, I have a number in the pipeline. I can tell you that we have, I think, a very strong case coming up in Pennsylvania for the same internet identifier issue. We have one in Virginia under the same issue. We have a strong case in Mississippi. Mississippi, this is egregious if you ask me, Andy, but if you're a registrant in Mississippi, you still have to carry around a separate ID card that says you're a sex offender.
Sure. Sure. Well, as we frequently say, is the further to the south you go, the more shitty it becomes. The group of people that claim to be all holier than thou and forgiveness, they really put the screws to you pretty hard.
Yeah, I mean, I always claim the Bible Belt is in general pretty tough. You know, when you get across the Bible Belt in the United States, the registry laws are very difficult. So I presume we're going to probably contest that case coming up. I have four other cases that will probably be brought in front of the legal committee here shortly. They never stop coming, Andy. I mean, these laws, I mean, we want to make the entire registry crumble, but we got to do it, you know, one chunk at a time. And I like to say, you know, West Virginia, we have a little newsletter for our state registrants. It's called The Crumbling Times. And basically, we just chisel away at it, you know, one statute at a time until the whole thing crumbles. So that's the idea.
Well, if you'll put on your advocate's hat for a moment, what would be a thing if you only have 6,000 people on the registry in West Virginia, which I'm surprised that there are even that many people that live in West Virginia, to be honest. So for those of the people that are listening in West Virginia, what would be, if you could ask them to do anything, is it money? Is it time? Is it contacts? What would be your wish list of having people in West Virginia help out?
Well, I would say, first of all, you know, you can go to the West Virginia RSOL, WVRSOL.org. Sign up for the newsletter. It's a complimentary newsletter. That's The Crumbling Times. The other thing they could do is if they want to support any of our legal functions, you know, NARSL filed these last two suits in West Virginia, but the state organization is paying for our filing fees, which can add up. I mean, thousands of dollars, actually, just to file these claims. So they can make contributions, even if it's a few bucks. I mean, a few bucks here and there, you know, we already know that $125 times is 800,000. I mean,
yes, we do have that math pretty apparent.
Then if you sent one-tenth of that to the state organization, it really helps them get the word out and, you know, get down in front of the legislators and and pay for the expenses that it costs to fight this nonsense off. So.
Well, I mean, if the 6,000 people, 6,700, if they all gave 10 bucks, you'd have 60,000 something bucks a year.
Yeah. If I could just get like 10,000,
I'm aware. And so many people, I totally know. I was just wondering if you could, you know, make that plea. Cause I would wonder, out of the 6,700, they perhaps see the law coming down the pike and then it will just potentially vanish and they'll have no idea what happened and it just went away and they never question, how did that happen? Did an organization step up for them to help out? And they'll just go on about their life and not be any the wiser that any of the affiliates exist, let alone Narsil.
That is probably accurate. I mean, there's a lot of people in West Virginia that live down in the holler, Andy. Up around the bend.
I know. I know.
Most of them don't have internet, so there you go.
They haven't really brought internet into West Virginia yet. You have that area in the state where there's some massive radio telescopes, and you can't have even radio signals going through that area. They're so far out in the boonies. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I know exactly where you mean.
Where is that?
I've been there before.
Have you really?
Yeah. You might as well forget your cell phone service while you're there.
Well, Stephen the paralegal, I really appreciate you coming on. We can close this down. We are right at 45 minutes, and that is enough time for me. Do you have anything else just to close it up? Anything else you want to say?
No, Andy, I appreciate you having me on. I'm glad I could help out. And hopefully Larry will be back with you the next time.
I hope so. He got stood up last week and we ended up recording early and the joke was on him. And then, so what we recorded early last week, he is doing now. That's why he can't get out of it. So anywho, well, I appreciate you coming on, Stephen, very much. And I hope to see you soon. And talk to you soon. And I hope everyone has a good night. Head over to registrymatters.co for show notes. And then email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can leave an old-fashioned voicemail message at 747-227-4477. And then, as I offered up before, patreon.com/registrymatters to become a patron for as little as a buck a month. And it helps keep this show going. Thank you again, Stephen. I hope you have a great night and good rest of your weekend. And I'll talk to you soon.
All right, guys. Take care.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.